Hey, J-Ro Show listeners. By now, you're probably familiar with the all-in-one investing platform, Public.com. Public recently launched options trading, and if you activate by March 31st, you can earn a lifetime rebate of 18 cents on every contract traded. That can add up to hundreds, even thousands of dollars in savings. Plus, unlike other investing platforms, Public doesn't charge commissions on per contract fees. So that's no commissions, no per contract fees, and a rebate of 18 cents on every contract traded. Discover the most cost-effective way to trade options and start getting something back on every contract, every trade. It only takes a couple of minutes to sign up at public.com. Paid for by Public Investing. Must activate options account by March 31st for revenue share. Options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description. U.S. members only.
Welcome to the J-Ro Show. On this podcast, your host, John Rotondi, interviews experts in and outside the world of investing. The J-Ro Show dives deep into what it takes to achieve mastery and sustain top-level performance. As a quick reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All opinions expressed by John or any of his podcast guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
I'm John Rotondi, and this is the J-Ro Show, a podcast that explores what it takes to achieve mastery, sustained performance, and longevity. The show hopes to uncover the processes, structures, frameworks, and mindsets that professionals put in place to maintain winning performance in their respective fields. Today, I am joined by Dan Davidowicz of Poland Capital. Dan is lead portfolio manager of Poland Capital's Focus Growth Strategy. The Poland Focus Growth Strategy generated net returns of 39% in 2023, and the strategy has some of the best long-term returns I've ever come across. The Focus Growth Strategy generated 14% annualized net returns over the last 10 years and 14.6% annualized net returns over the last 5 years. Since inception, going back 35 years, the Poland Focus Growth Strategy has generated 13.5% annualized net returns. And you can see these returns are remarkably consistent with roughly 14% net annualized returns over 5 years, 10 years, and since inception over 35 years. Dan, welcome to the J-Ro Show.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me on your show.
So glad to be doing this. Dan, I don't normally start with a question about culture, but I'm going to do it here because Poland has been named a best place to work by Pensions and Investments for 8 consecutive years. And I got a glimpse into this culture recently. So Dan, you and I ran into each other a couple weeks ago at the Student Investment Conference at the University of Alabama, where you were giving a presentation on competitive advantages. And before your presentation, you and I got to catch up one-on-one, and we talked a bit about markets, and we talked about a stock, and we talked a bit about thesis drift. And then I asked you about a dear friend of mine that is a superstar analyst at Poland. And you told me that my friend is doing well. And then you went on to tell me that she was supposed to travel with you to visit Thermo Fisher, but that she had to miss the work trip because her husband parent passed away in India. And so my friend had to stay home with their newborn baby. But what struck me, Dan, was that you knew my friend's husband's name and her baby's name. While telling me this story, you called her husband and baby by name. And it was in that moment that I realized why Poland is named a best place to work year in and year out. And it was in that moment that I realized that Poland really is family. So my question is, what else can you share about Poland's culture? What makes it such a great place to work?
Well, John, first of all, I love that we're starting with culture because it's what makes Poland Capital unique, I think. Yeah. And it was your friend's husband's grandparent.
Okay.
But I just only want to correct you because you put it in such detail.
I'm glad that you corrected that. Thank you.
No, and you know, that's one of the unique attributes of our culture is that we really care about our colleagues, you know, and I think one of the things that our culture embodies is a radical candor approach. Mm-hmm. And radical candor means we can be open and honest with each other, not in a mean way ever, but in a helpful way, that we all want to help each other be better. The only way you can really have radical candor is to really care about your teammates, right? Yes. Really care about the people around you, or else it's going to not the candor itself, your advice, your constructive criticisms are not going to land very well. If my teammates don't believe that I care about them, well, certainly they're not going to care about what I'm delivering in constructive criticism. So in order to be a open and honest place to work where we can be helpful to each other and deliver candid feedback, you have to really care about each other. And so trust and caring is kind of a unique thing, I think, at Poland Capital that allows us to not only have a great place to work, as you know, we have been highly rated on that, but also that we all become the best versions of ourselves, which makes us the best at what we do for our clients as well.
Yeah, and I love that. It's a culture built on radical candor and striving to become the best versions of yourself. And to do that, it's really built on trust and caring. Yeah. Right. So Dan, tell us about Poland Capital.
Mm-hmm. Poland Capital, as you mentioned, is the portfolio that I manage, which is called Focus Growth. It was the original flagship Poland Capital product. Mm-hmm. That goes back to 1989. The firm itself actually goes back to 1979. Our founder, David Poland, who passed away about 12 years ago, created an investment philosophy that was, you know, based on owning a highly concentrated group of very high quality growth companies. And, you know, David, when he started Poland Capital, was in his 40s. So he had already been around and on Wall Street for a long time. He was a broker. He had made a lot of mistakes in how he invested his clients' money. And it was through this journey when he eventually started his own investment firm and he, you know, learned from all of his mistakes. He learned from studying, you know, Ben Graham and Warren Buffett. And when he finally got around to what his true investment philosophy was going to be, it was a very disciplined way of investing that takes some of the core tenets of value investing and applies them to growth stocks. And we can get into more detail on that if you'd like. And what we did is, and what he did was really created this portfolio, what became the Focus Growth portfolio, which is a 20 to 25 stock portfolio, highly concentrated, but in companies that have to meet very strict financial hurdles, very high quality hurdles, and have to have very unique and persistent competitive advantages and real long-term growth to them. So it's a very small subset of the world that we look at for our portfolios. And then we stay very disciplined on that. So David ran the portfolio for over 20 years this way, basically on his own. I came in 2005. I became a portfolio manager with him, co-portfolio manager in 2007. And then, you know, I've been kind of leading the product for a long time now, about 15, 16 years. And we remain very disciplined, doing it the exact same way, same philosophy, same process, a bigger team now doing it. And then Poland Capital has then extended into new products. So my team is our large cap investment team, and we manage three, now four products that are mostly separated by geography. And then we have three other investment teams at Poland Capital that are separate and autonomous. And there's one up in Boston that focuses on small cap companies. We have an emerging markets team that's based in London and Hong Kong. And then we also have a credit team, which is in Waltham, Massachusetts, actually not too far from our Boston office, that does mostly US high yield, but is extending into other credit products as well. So the firm has become more diversified over the years. But one of the key attributes is we have some core tenets. I already mentioned radical candor, but some of the core tenets of Poland Capital are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And so autonomy, you have the ability to do work the way you want to do it. We call it freedom within a framework. So we have kind of guardrails on what you can do, but within those guardrails, you can do it however you want. It also applies to our teams. We have four investment teams, but they're separate. They're autonomous from each other. And we have shared services that do the business management, the distribution, the trading and operations. We have that kind of common shared infrastructure, but the teams themselves are autonomous. We believe in mastery, which means everybody should be striving to continuous improvement, marginal improvements. We actually document those every year. Every employee has three marginal benefits that there are marginal improvements that they're going for during the year, which, as you'd imagine, is amplified across the 260 employees of Poland Capital. And every employee gets a budget every year of over $5,000 that you have to spend on training. And it can be on whatever you want, whatever is going to make you a better person or a better professional. And it doesn't have to be directly applicable to your job. It is something we want. So every year you get that budget to use. And then purpose. And our purpose is first and foremost to our clients, to make sure that we do all the right things to allow them to protect and grow their capital, but also to our people. Again, to make sure that we are the best versions of ourselves. And then, of course, to our communities. And now we're present in a number of communities, not just where our headquarters is in Boca Raton, Florida, but in the Boston area, in London, in Hong Kong. We strive to do the best for our communities to make them a better place, because that's where we live, right? We want to make the places where we live better. So all of those are kind of part and parcel of Poland Capital. And there's a lot more detail, of course, behind that, but that's the big picture.
That was a beautiful overview of Poland Capital and how the culture is built on these core tenets. You know, one of them being mastery, and this is a podcast that tries to explore what it takes to achieve mastery and the processes that go into that. So I love that. Another was, this idea of freedom within a framework and autonomy, which I'm going to ask you about in a second. But I wanted to double back quickly on the three marginal improvements. Do the employees choose those on their own, or are those chosen in conjunction with the help of the manager they report to? How do they choose what three improvements they're going to work on every year?
Yeah, it's originally chosen by the employee themselves. It's things that they want to improve upon themselves. Of course, the manager will go over them with them to make sure that they are relevant or that they think it makes sense. I would say, without knowing for sure, I would say that 90-ish, 99 maybe percent of the time they stand. You know, what the employee chooses is what they end up doing. Maybe you have your manager or your supervisor, nudging you on things that they think you might be able to incorporate in there. And these are not giant improvements. They're called marginal for a reason. They're things you want to be a little bit better at, or maybe blind spots that you have that you want to start to make progress against. They're not big audacious goals, right? These are marginal improvements, and it's just something that makes you better. For instance, one of my marginal improvements years ago was to talk a bit less in meetings. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I found was I was kind of crowding out my team sometimes. I was the most experienced member of the team, and so I felt like it was my duty sometimes to kind of keep putting opinions forth or keep talking. And I was getting feedback from my own team that they didn't really like that. And that's, by the way, again, radical candor, right? That they were not getting enough opportunities to opine. So one of my marginal improvements was not just to not talk as much, but to write down more during the meetings. And what that means is when things would pop in my head that I would normally want to say, I would first write it down. And, so I won't forget it. And maybe if nobody else talks about this, we'll come back to it. But what happened was I started to learn a lot more in those meetings because I was fully paying attention now to what everybody else was saying. 9 times out of 10, somebody else already talked about what I would have wanted to talk about anyway. Right. And they had a slightly different view on it. And that changed my mind or brought me new learnings or something. So this little marginal improvement, talk a little less, write down what you want to say, and then listen a little bit more, pay attention, be intentional. I started to see some real improvements in what I was getting out of our meetings.
Yeah. And, those marginal improvements compound over time and they build up over time. And when you do it across the entire organization, it just speaks to how well run Poland is and what y'all are able to accomplish for your investors. So you talked about freedom within a framework. The analyst can go look for businesses that meet what you said were very strict criteria, and y'all look at a very tiny subset of stocks in the world because only a very tiny subset of stocks meet all of your strict criteria. So what types of businesses do you like to buy stock in? What are these guardrails that your analysts have to work inside of?
Yeah, and I'm going to give you a little detail on that. One thing I'll say before I start is the freedom within a framework applies to everybody at Poland Capital, not just the investment teams and not just what they can look at. That's our framework, right? We have our framework that's based on our guardrails, but freedom within a framework applies to every Poland Capital person in their specific role. They have, you know, kind of an area with which they have to kind of stay within, but then once they're within there, they can figure out the best way to do that. And that applies to, you know, your whole life at Poland Capital, which we can also get into later if you'd like. When it comes to our team and the framework that you mentioned, we have five guardrails that every company has to meet. You have to meet all five of our guardrails to be included in our portfolios for the large company team. So the five guardrails are, number one, you have to have a cash-rich balance sheet with very little debt. We really don't like debt at all. We will limit to roughly 3x current free cash flow in net debt. So said another way, that you'd be able to pay off all of your debt in less than 3 years.
Sure.
And we really, if you look at focused growth, you're going to see that the portfolio is mostly in a net cash position. Almost every holding is in a net cash position. We want, number two, companies to have excess free cash flow every single year, not just when times are good. Number three, you have to have a sustainable return on capital above 20%, which is a very, very high hurdle for most companies.
Yeah.
We have to have stable to increasing profit margins, and we have to have organic revenue growth that's better than the average company. So think, you know, at least mid to high single digit revenue growth organically. And each one of these hurdles is fairly high in and of themselves, but we string together all five and
right.
say, meet all of these. And when we look for our large company team, you know, we're looking at large cap companies across the globe. The focus growth strategy is a US centric portfolio, but our team is global. And when we look across the globe, there's really only about 300 to 350 companies that even meet those guardrails
wow.
at any particular time in the large cap space. And when we do our research, right, you know, there is some freedom then within that group to do your research and to figure out what you think are the best ones. Really only about 160 to 170 of those companies do we think have real sustainability that are ones that we understand quite well and are potentially a candidate. So when you think about how many large companies there are, you know, in the world, we're looking at, you know, maybe 5 to 10% of them as potential candidates for any one of our portfolios. So the universe shrinks very fast just by these quality criteria before we even do our research.
Yes, I love how you put numbers around how large your potential, I mean, the size of your potential universe. It's not large, it's very small, but you put numbers around the size of your potential universe and then how you whittle that down based on those that you think have, you know, what you call a persistent, sustainable competitive advantage. And that's even before you start doing the deep research.
Right.
Yeah. And I just want to mention quickly the emphasis that y'all do place on the persistence and durability of that competitive advantage. I just heard your speech a couple of weeks ago, your presentation you gave. It was the best presentation I've ever heard around competitive advantage. And, you know, you talked about not just how to potentially identify one, and you talked about not only the potential sources of competitive advantage, but also how to think about that durability. And I've heard lots of presentations on competitive advantages over the years, and it's something I think a lot about, but it was the best all around presentation on moats and their sources and the durability of those moats I've ever seen. So it was excellent.
That's very kind of you, John. I think the competitive advantage, I think we all have a view on what competitive advantage is. A lot of people spend some time on it. It's well documented. You know, Warren Buffett talks about, you know, wanting to own castles with large moats around them. You know, so he's really kind of coined that moat term around the idea of competitive advantage. But competitive advantage, you know, comes in a lot of different shapes and sizes and a lot of different types. And some of them are very durable and some of them are a little weaker. And some of them require a lot more reinvestment than others do. And you have to know, you know, a lot of people shorthand it with the terms like narrow moat, wide moat, and that's probably a good visual on a lot of them. But what we really want to find are companies that have many competitive advantages.
Overlapping competitive advantage, yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes you'll have one nice competitive advantage and then all of a sudden it's not so much of a competitive advantage anymore because, you know, this is the real world. You have real businesses that compete in a capitalistic type environment. They're gonna try to get excess profits. So if you have multiple layers of competitive advantage, that's where the real excitement is, especially when it meets a very large market opportunity. And so those are the kind of businesses we're always looking for, which means we're not always going to have the fastest grower in the short term or the most exciting companies, but we're going to have these kind of durable, almost kind of like marathon runner type companies as opposed to the sprinters. You know, we're going to have a lot more of those durable companies that are going to compound for long periods of time. Oftentimes, they're not super exciting companies. We've owned Accenture now in our portfolio for over 17 years. Wow. And almost as much time as I've been at Poland Capital. And it is a very durable, unsexy, low teens earnings grower, mid teens annualized investment return. It's doubling every 5 years. And I can count the number of times on one hand that a client has asked me about Accenture. It never comes up in conversation, but Accenture is kind of a down the middle Poland Capital holding. There's just like durable, competitive, multi-layered competitive advantages, wide open growth potential, very differentiated product or service that can compound for very long periods of time without a whole lot of headaches or stress. You know, that's the kind of company we're looking for.
I like how you used the analogy of a marathon runner, because these are long duration compounders, long duration growers that have a long runway of reinvestment, and they have these reinforcing competitive advantages. Just really quickly back to the universe, you and I have been talking, I think, back to 2018 or even before that. And I think at one point you told me that the Poland focus strategy over its lifetime had only ever owned like 200 stocks or something like that, over 30 years.
Yeah, so that number you're quoting is a little high. It's actually quite a bit lower than that. The number as of right now, we're in the process of buying one right now. It'll be number 132.
Wow.
We've ever owned, and that includes the 23 that we own right now. And that's an important statistic, not just because we strive to have the lowest number possible. Like, that's not really what the number is, the output.
It speaks to the discipline.
It speaks to the way we think returns are generated, at least for our style of investing. There are lots of ways and lots of great investors that do very interesting and different things than we do. What we're trying to do is to create earnings growth, a portfolio of mid-teens earnings growth.
Yeah.
And if we can be disciplined, you know, to not pay too much, you know, and we're not buying, you know, 50 cent dollars here. You know, we're buying dollars. Mm-hmm. But those dollars are compounding at a mid-teens rate.
Sure. Right?
And so what we're trying to do is allow the earnings growth to drive the returns of the portfolio. You quoted our historical net returns. They correlate extremely well with the underlying earnings growth of the portfolio as well. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. So to do that, you want to find companies that can compound for long periods of time, like an Accenture, and you don't have to continuously replace those companies as long as they continue to compound. So the number, that 132, is really just telling you the compounding is happening with a small group of companies that continues to do this for long periods of time. So we don't have to replace that many of them, you know, over time.
And you spoke to the correlation. You know, if you're targeting 15% earnings per share growth at the portfolio level over time, and over time you've generated 14% annualized returns, and that's after fees, right? So on a gross level, it's probably very, very correlated.
Yeah, it's almost spot on, right?
Exactly.
Over almost every 5 year or more rolling time horizon, you're going to see roughly 15% earnings growth, roughly 15% gross returns, and 14 net. Yeah.
Hi, J-Row Show listeners. If you were to ask me for three features I'm looking for in a stock research platform that I live in every day, I'd say institutional quality data, alternative data and KPIs, and quick and easy robust charting functionality. FinChat.io has all of that. I use FinChat, I love it, and it has quickly become my go-to data source for my stock research. I think of FinChat as a complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. The platform has a beautiful design and institutional quality data, so it is incredibly powerful and easy to use. Beyond having all the standard financial data for companies around the globe, FinChat has company-specific segments and KPIs on over 1,500 stocks. Want to see Home Depot's average ticket price or sales per square foot? Are you curious about United Rentals' number of locations, market share, or fleet original equipment cost? Well, FinChat tracks all those KPIs and literally 500,000 more. And if you aren't sure where to go, simply ask FinChat. With FinChat's conversational AI, you can save tons of time researching stocks. FinChat also has a DCF modeling tool, a robust screening tool, 10 plus years of conference call transcripts, and also hedge fund letters, consensus estimates, and tons more. To get 25% off any paid plan, go to finchat.io/JRO. That's finchat.io/JRO. The link will also be in the show notes. So, you know, we just talked about at the portfolio level, you're targeting, you know, 15%-ish earnings per share growth over time. So let's just dive a little bit more into the portfolio management philosophy. I think you said you own between 20 and 25 stocks. Right now it's 23, I think. What else can you tell us? Like, what's the average starter position size? What would you consider to be a full position size? And do you hold cash typically, or are you typically fully invested?
Yeah, I'll let the last part first is we try to stay very fully invested. We don't really want to have transient cash in the portfolio for a couple of reasons. One, our clients don't want us to. You know, mm-hmm. Most of our clients have separate cash or cash-like allocations. The investment with them in Poland Capital is an equity return. They really want to be fully invested. So that's one. The other reason is because if you can compound at 14, 15% per year, every 1% cash is a 14, 15 basis point drag on that performance. So it really doesn't make sense to do that. And when I looked at our David Poland, he had historically carried around 5% cash in the portfolio. That was a very big headwind to annualized performance when you're compounding over decades. So we decided we're not going to do that. So we keep as little cash as possible. As far as position sizing goes, I will tell you, we have a theory on this what we've done. I can tell you it's evolving though, because our view is that we haven't been great at portfolio sizing. So even though we've had good returns, our sizing hasn't delivered excess return, meaning mm-hmm. our highest weights have delivered roughly the same returns as our mid-size and smaller weights. So it basically argues we should have been either equally weighted over time, or we just should figure out a better way to create our weighting. So we're trying to figure out a better way right now. But what we typically do is a starter weight would be in the, call it 1% to 3% mm-hmm. range, building up to an average weight of between 4 and 6%. Percent is kind of normal. And then if we feel like we have a unique set of circumstances that would create the willingness to have a larger position, then we'll do that. And that has to be like a confluence of four things happening at the same time. So we have to have, a company that has an unbelievably large competitive advantage. So not just, we want all companies to have competitive advantage, but it has to be among the best of the best for us to have a very large weighting. It has to have very fast earnings growth, even for our portfolio. It has to have a valuation that's very exciting. I'd say we typically buy dollars. It has to be better than that for mm-hmm. us to size large. And then it also has to be somewhat timely, meaning there has to be a reason to want to have a large position. Now, I'm not necessarily talking about a catalyst per se, because I know a lot of people like to size based on a specific catalyst. But when I say timeliness, I mean more our earnings and revenue growth accelerating. Yeah. That would be, you're never going to see us size, very large, a decelerating growth company, even if the other three criteria are met. If it's decelerating, you're not going to see us, make it a large position. So we think we have, extremely strong moat growth, very exciting valuation, and a timeliness factor on earnings growth accelerating, that's when you'll see us make big positions. And so today we actually have the largest position we've ever had, which is a 15% position in Amazon which we went to about a year ago. We made it that large because we saw a confluence of those four things happening at the same time. And it was a very discounted valuation, trading at the time at only about 20 times free cash flow.
Wow.
And we saw a massive inflection in cash flow coming, which is happening right now. So that's when, excuse me, we'll do that, is when we have those things. Now, I mentioned, you know, our sizing historically hasn't been a key differentiator for us. So what we're trying to do right now is get a little bit more systematic on those four factors. You know, can we weight some of those? You know, sure. Weight the moat, the growth, the valuation, and the timeliness, so that it gives us a better idea of what the sizing should be as we rank those things and weight those things. And so we're in a process of figuring that out at the moment. And I think, you know, we'll be better at it going forward.
Well, that's exciting because, you know, the portfolio has done so well over time. With these,
again, marginal improvements, we can always do that.
Exactly, marginal improvements. So that's really exciting. And I look forward to seeing how that develops. The other thing I just want to point out to my listeners is just how disciplined y'all are with frameworks and guardrails. I mean, we started off the show, you talked about the five guardrails, the five checks that every single investment in your portfolio has to meet, and they have to meet all five. Mm-hmm. And then just now you talked about the four conditions in which you would size up a position. Mm-hmm. And it has to meet all four. Mm-hmm. And so there's just so much structure and process behind, you know, what you and your team do. And I think that speaks to the success that y'all have had over time.
I appreciate that, John. I mean, I think it's always a work in progress, though. I think that's the thing is we're making probabilistic investments in what are already great proven companies, but, you know, we only know their past. We don't know the future. We hope we have a series of facts that backs up a reason to have a reasonable expectation in the future. But again, these companies operate in the real world with humans making decisions that aren't always optimal. And so we have to also be very aware that, you know, whatever we've done or whatever we are doing may not always be the right way, right? What got you here may not get you there. We use that term a lot inside of Poland Capital. And so we're constantly going back over our processes and getting coaches to come in. We have coaches that are constantly working with us on everything to make it, you know, reevaluate what we do here at Poland Capital. I think there are things that are kind of sacrosanct that we would never get rid of, like our guardrails. Our investment guardrails are very, very important to keep us in a stocked pond of highly advantaged companies. Yes. I think we're not going to see us scrap those guardrails. But everything else that we do, we try to be very open-minded. Is there a better way to do it? We never want to say, well, we do it this way because that's the way we've always done it. You know, the world changes. You know, David Poland investing in 1990 and 1991, it was a very different environment, you know, to what we are doing today. We're still investing the same way with the underlying philosophy and process behind that, but we're constantly trying to iterate on that process to make it a little bit better, a little bit more thoughtful, a little bit more open-minded, so that when times change, we don't just sit there like, you know, sticking our head in the sand and assuming that whatever worked, you know, in the PC era days is going to continue to work.
Yeah. And it's that commitment to becoming the best version of y'all selves. Mm-hmm. How do you think about risk management and managing risk in the portfolio?
I think the most important thing that we do on risk management is sticking to our guardrails, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we stick to the guardrails, even if the business isn't wildly competitively advantaged, what it is going to be is cash rich, cash flow generative, high return on capital, high margin growth, right? So even our mistakes end up being more opportunity costs than they end up being capital impairments. Yep. Because these are still great companies. They have great financial metrics. Just to be included in the conversation, you have to have, you know, something unique and special and pristine financials. And so that is first and foremost. You know, risk to us is not, you know, the variability of the stock prices. Risk to us is the chance of permanent capital loss. And so the guardrails themselves keep us in a much safer place because it keeps us out of companies that have a lot of debt. Mm-hmm. Debt is very, very risky for businesses. Out of companies that have undifferentiated products and services that could easily be substituted for a competitor. Highly regulated businesses, highly capital intensive businesses, highly cyclical businesses, those don't meet our criteria, right? So those are automatically just pushed aside. Those are kind of the risky characteristics of businesses. So the genius of what David Poland created was he's taking away the riskiest parts of businesses, and all you have left are businesses that have wonderful balance sheets and cash flows and revenue growth. And that's a cool place to start, right? Because it's just harder to lose money in those businesses. Then the next step is really understanding the competitive advantage and what can undo the competitive advantages. How can this business not be great going forward? Almost taking counterfactuals, right? Mm-hmm. What would be something that would undo this or make this less good? Maybe a technological change or maybe a behavioral change of customers or something, right? We have to really think it through and test it. And so we're constantly trying to figure out ways that a company won't be successful going forward. And that's really the key to risk management. Portfolio sizing or looking at like Barra factor, we don't do any of that stuff, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I understand why people would want to look at those things, but for us, it's about owning the best companies, the easiest way to compound mid-teens type earnings growth or better, and doing it the easiest possible way. I talk a lot. I don't like to quote Warren Buffett because everybody quotes Warren Buffett.
Right.
I already quoted him once when I talked about moats, but his best quote for me is there's no extra points for degree of difficulty in investing. And I really, truly believe that. You know, when we invest, we want to really understand the business. We want it to be crayon simple was a terminology that David Polin used to use. And I love that terminology. And our best investments have been nothing earth shattering, nothing that we discovered that other people didn't know. Like Visa and MasterCard have been two of our best compounders for long periods of time. Our original investment thesis was people will spend more money every year than they do the year before. There's a 4-5% uplift from cash and check going to digital forms of payment every year. And they can raise prices, 3-5% per year. That was our original investment thesis 15 years ago. It's still the investment thesis. And it's actually just happening. It's not that we discovered anything genius about Visa and MasterCard. We just saw how big the opportunity was, how enormous their competitive advantages are, and how long this could go on for. And that was it. That was the key insight on those two companies. And so all of our big winners are like that.
Just real quickly, thinking about Visa and MasterCard and going back to your idea of reinforcing moats, multiple reinforcing moats. If you just think about Visa and MasterCard really quickly, they have a globally trusted and recognized brand. That's one. I'm sure I'm going to miss some. I'm not an expert. But so they've got this globally trusted and recognized brand. They've got global scale. And then they've got network effects.
Yeah.
And those three just reinforce each other to drive that sort of high single digit organic growth that you were talking about.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. They have multiple levels of competitive advantages. This industry and those two companies in particular are about the most competitively advantaged businesses we've ever seen. And that's a lot because that's all we play in is highly competitively advantaged businesses. It's the reason we've owned both of them for such a long period of time and a meaningful weight in the portfolio. It is. And we try to undo it too. We're like, okay, what would it take for someone else to replicate the network or for competing technology, right? For a while, everybody thought blockchain technology might really upend this industry, right? And part of the problem with the bear cases on companies like Visa and MasterCard is they're often conflating things like interchange and the cost to retailers with what Visa and MasterCard do. Visa and MasterCard don't charge interchange. They make a small network fee off of every transaction. So people, think about the 2-3% that the merchant gets charged and they're always angry over. But Visa and MasterCard make basis points per transactions. The banks are the ones that make the interchange, right? And so, and you're right. We've tried to figure out if someone wanted to replicate this network, what would it take? And you immediately say, well, it's next to impossible for that to happen at global scale with the millions of points of acceptance and hundreds of banks that trust them, being able to process transactions with 99.99% uptime and no latency, or to reverse those transactions on a fraud or return situation and to do it at a cost that is so low, that would be extremely hard. When we were listening to people talk about blockchain technology, as a potential disruptor here, we were like, okay, Visa and MasterCard process, or can process tens of thousands of transactions per millisecond.
Yeah.
It takes blockchain technology minutes to process, transactions, and even a small, much smaller number of transactions. Blockchains only move in one direction. You can't go backwards for fraud or return. You know, like there are things that you can't do with blockchain. And then there was innovations for payments that were kind of sort of blockchain that would take the transactions off the chain to speed them up. Well, now you're just trying to do it. Visa and MasterCard already do a lot cheaper. So like, I don't understand the, you know, we're always looking for the holes that we can poke in these businesses. And we will, if we find them, you know, we may have to exit at some point. We're not so closed-minded, but you know, it really is a high hurdle for some of these great companies.
Yeah. And I love that you said that the Warren Buffett quote that speaks most to you is there's no extra points for degree of difficulty. And it brings me back to your presentation again at the University of Alabama, because so you gave this presentation on moats, and then you gave examples of companies in your portfolio that have these moats. And at the end of the presentation, you took questions from the audience, and someone in the audience said something like, I notice all of your companies are sort of secular growers, meaning that their growth is independent of the economic cycle. And so this person in the audience asked you, do you ever invest in cyclicals? And your answer was just so perfect. If I misquote you, please tell me, but it was something like, we have nothing preventing us from investing in more cyclical businesses, but our goal is to achieve that 15% earnings per share growth at the portfolio level in the easiest way possible, mm-hmm. in the simplest path that we can.
Yeah.
And you said, you know, cyclicals don't offer us that right now. Is that kind of how it happened?
Yeah, I mean, you hit it on the head. And the other thing I would remind everybody when you think about that is, yeah, we are not against the idea of a cyclical business. You know, especially if there's a secular growth that's well in excess of the cyclical nature of the business, right? There are a lot of companies that have some cyclicality to them, but there's a giant opportunity for them. And we'd be fine owning business. You're not going to see us owning highly cyclical businesses where the earnings growth just never really, you know, has an upward trajectory to it. It just kind of bounces around a mean. If it's doing that, we have no interest. But if it's a long-term kind of up and to the right type growth with a lot of variability around it, that's fine. But yeah, we want to get it the easiest way that we can. And we just happen to be lucky that we invest in this portfolio in mostly US companies. And there's a lot of highly competitively advantaged growth companies. You know, it's not like, you know, I mentioned the universe is relatively small, like 160, 170 that we, you know, really look at as potential candidates for the portfolio, but that's enough. You don't need to have a lot more than that when you're constructing a 20 stock portfolio of advantaged businesses. So we would consider, and we have considered, and we've even owned some businesses that I would argue have some cyclicality to them. But if we don't need to do it, why do it? You know, there's not like a need for us to say, well, you know, we don't have any cyclicals, we should throw one in there, or, you know, we're going to predict that there's going to be an upswing in, you know, whatever infrastructure spending coming, you know, so we can invest behind that with XYZ company. We're not really trying to do that. We're looking for these durable compounders that can go for years and years and years. And if we can find those, great. And if we need to, you know, put in a business that has some cyclicality to it, that's fine too. But like you said, easiest possible way is usually the best way.
Yeah. Yeah. Dan, how many people are on the investing team at Poland, and are the analysts generalists or specialists?
Yeah, today we are an 11-person investment team. And yes, we are all generalists. Generalists by industry, you know, industry sector, we all have different companies, different industries, different sectors under our primary coverage. Most of us also are pretty generalist by geography as well. So mm-hmm. have companies all over the globe. There are some exceptions to that because, you know, I run a US-centric portfolio. You know, my coverage universe is very US-centric. Our PMs that run our international portfolio, Todd and Dan, they're mostly covering companies outside the US, but everybody else is pretty much even distribution in different countries.
So your title is lead portfolio manager and analyst. Mm-hmm. As lead portfolio manager, do you still serve as primary analyst on companies? And if so, How do you split your time between the analyst role and the portfolio manager role, which I assume involves things removed from research, such as travel to meet with clients or other things like that? So can you please discuss your various responsibilities and what percentage of your time they consume?
Yeah, in a general sense, most of my time is spent as an analyst. And I think that's kind of normal for investment teams like us that are fundamentally driven. We are low turnover. We tend to have turnover in the teens all in. And so we don't have a whole lot of new investment ideas. If you think about that, like if our turnover ends up being teens and that includes ads and trims, you're probably only adding 1, 2, 3 companies to the portfolio per year.
Yeah,
with 11 people. You know, trying to find that next great business. So most of my time is spent as an analyst. And yes, I do have primary research coverage on about 10 or 11 companies. Like I said, mine are mostly US businesses. Not all of them are in the portfolio. Some of them are not in the portfolio. And I do try to help out as an analyst for our other portfolios too, even though it's probably to a little bit more limited degree, especially with our international portfolio, because my coverage is mostly US. But if I can help with understanding U.S. companies that compete with some of those international companies, then I do help with that. I really love the process of research. To me, it's just fun. I'm a little bit of a different kind of researcher than a lot of my teammates or a lot of people I know in the investment industry love to just read and read and read. And I've heard some of your previous guests talk about that, you know, being buried in papers and reading all day and finding joy out of that. I'm not like that. I do read a lot, but I read in spurts. I don't tend to like immerse myself for hours at a time. We have these lights, you know, we're in a lead building where the lights will go out if there's no motion for a long period of time. Some of my analysts, the lights go out and they're still grinding away reading.
Right.
And they're for hours and hours and hours. And I envy that. I really do, but that's not the way I work. I tend to work in like 30 to 60 minute bursts. And then I need to kind of walk around, move around, interact with people. But I eventually get there with all the information I need to read. It just happens in a more choppy fashion, I think, than most other people do. But most of my time is spent doing research, and not just on the primary companies that I cover, but on everybody's recommendations or coverage for that could be a focus growth candidate. So I do a lot of my own work on the same companies that others are working on as well. I try to collaborate with them the best I can. Right now we have a very interesting situation, which has almost never happened, where we have a company that I'm working on with two of my colleagues on our team. It happens to be a company that one of our other teams owns as well in their portfolio. So we're actually doing cross team meetings as well, which rarely happens because there's not that many companies that overlap between our teams. So it does happen more and more between our international portfolio managers and our emerging growth portfolio managers. But I spend most of my time working on research. Portfolio management is a very small amount of my time. It's 5% or less of my time. We don't make a lot of decisions on the portfolio because of exactly what we talked about before, that these are companies that are compounding for years and years and years. Usually you kind of let them be. For the most part, client interaction is a pretty big part of my job, and it is for all of my teammates too. Probably more so for the portfolio managers, definitely more so for the portfolio managers than the analysts. But I think it's a crucial part of research too, right? Being able to get difficult questions from clients. Our clients never shy away from asking tough questions, and because we run a concentrated portfolio, you get a lot of questions on the individual companies. And if you can't articulate a really strong investment thesis, then maybe you don't have one, right? Yep. Maybe you need to rethink. And some of our clients' questions are fantastic. We get really good, thoughtful questions. We write a lot of white papers now. One of my colleagues, Steve Atkins, is the author of a lot of our white papers. And a lot of those white papers come from client interactions where we get very thoughtful questions. We want to go back and do some more research on it and put out something thoughtful for all of our clients. And so I think client interactions are part of the research process. Now you just have to figure out how to balance all of those things to make sure that you have plenty of time to, make sure you're learning about the companies you already own, you know, not missing big things, finding new ideas. You know, you need to figure out how to balance all those. But I think client interactions are crucial. So if I had to kind of proportion it out, I would say roughly 30% of my time is with clients, you know, 5% on portfolio management, and then, you know, the balance is research.
Yeah, and those white papers that y'all publish on your website are excellent. I read them all. Sometimes I tweet about them, so I love them. You said that you cover about 10 to 11. You're the primary analyst on about 10 to 11 stocks.
Yeah.
Roughly how many stocks do the other analysts typically cover? Is that kind of average across the team?
No, the analysts, portfolio managers tend to cover a little bit less.
Sure.
And the analysts a little bit more. I would say, you know, the range is probably between like 10 and 20 ish. And so like 10 is like a little bit on the low end, 20 would be on the high end, and it's somewhere in between. So averages out to about 15 per person.
And, you know, 23 stocks in the portfolio, very low portfolio turnover. So how many new ideas are analysts expected to pitch each year?
So this is maybe a little bit different than other firms. Analysts are not expected to do that. We're not expecting a certain number of actionable ideas or anything. What we want to do is to make sure that the universe of companies that we think are potential candidates are covered very, very well.
Yes.
And so if nothing that I cover is exciting, you know, or something that I think deserves to be in the portfolio, I am not going to recommend any of them. I'm not going to come forth with any of them. But what I am going to do is I'm going to write a research report on them every quarter. Right. So if you thought, you know, that we have, like, as I said, roughly 160, 170 companies that are very actively followed. Mm-hmm. Every one of those companies has a research note written at least once a quarter on them. And those research notes, there's a lot of autonomy here. You write it however you want to write it. The point is to convey to the team the most important aspects of what you know about the business at that moment in time. It doesn't have to be, you know, on an earnings report. It can be. A lot of people do it that way because mm-hmm. that's why they're in the flow of those companies. But it's really open. Like, you write whatever you want. Usually the first time we research a company, because, you know, there are, you know, the initial research projects that we do, we usually have a deliverable in that case. And it's only after probably a few weeks worth of work, the primary analyst will be asked to present it to the whole team to kind of bring us all along with them. We don't want to have an analyst like, you know, 90 yards ahead of us, and we're trying to come from behind to understand the business. So we want them to, you know, start the process, bring us up to speed on the 80-20 rule. Like, what are the most important things we need to know about this business? What does it do? How does it work? What's the competition like? What's the industry like? And then we're just going to ask a ton of questions at that first meeting. And it's the things we would need to know if we wanted to invest in the company. So that initial presentation, usually it's a PowerPoint. I like them to be short, but they can be as long as you want them to be. And, you know, we're going to ask a lot of questions. We're not going to have a lot of answers yet. And then the research moves on from there to an iterative process where the analyst is now going to every quarter write a report that's answering the questions that were brought up. And hopefully over time, we get enough of those answers to then consider it as a portfolio candidate later. And it'll likely be represented at some point, you know, when we feel like we have enough information. And then there's no votes at those meetings. You know, we don't have a research committee or anything. It's our whole investment team that listens and asks a lot of questions and answers. But as far as whether or not we're going to own a company, that's just the portfolio manager separately that will say, you know, for our product, do we want to own this company? If so, how much would we like to buy? Do we need to source cash from another holding? What would we be doing? So those are kind of separate decisions away from the rest of the team.
So just so I understand it, so, you know, you have these 160 to 170 companies that the team is really focused on. Each one of those is covered by some analyst. Mm-hmm. And the analyst will update the team with some sort of write-up mm-hmm. each quarter on those 160 or 170.
That's right.
And then if an analyst believes a new name should be added to that list, to, you know, to your investable universe list, for instance, then they, you know, after a couple of weeks of researching it, they will put together some sort of deliverable, a write-up or a PowerPoint, and present it to the team. Mm-hmm. And then from there, if the team thinks it's worth researching more, they'll continue to research it, and it becomes an iterative process, and they build up their knowledge on that name over time. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And yeah, we have our research meetings are kind of split up into a couple of different versions. And we do this on Wednesday. So Wednesday is kind of research meeting day. Mm-hmm. We used to, during COVID, we had them on broken up on Mondays and Fridays, but now that we're kind of back to sort of normal, we have them in one day. And so what we do is, in the morning, we'll have 2 to 3 hours of discussions on two or three companies. Mm-hmm. And those companies are either those initial research report presentations or a report on one of our existing holdings or a potential new addition to the portfolio. So it's either, you know, the initial research presentation, a more final research presentation, or a rehash on one of our existing holdings. We do that once a year on all of our existing holdings too. So that's the morning is spent doing those kind of presentations. And then later in the afternoon, we do what we call our universe discussion, which is, are there companies that we don't have in our coverage universe that we should? Mm-hmm. And so we go through, David Poland had a process of flipping value lines. And I know you've talked to some of your guests about doing that. You're certainly dating us when we admit to flipping value lines. And I worked at Value Line, by the way. So we can, that's something that unique, I'm hoping, from all of your guests. But David Poland used to like flipping the issues of value lines. Now it's gotten a little bit archaic, even though I love the presentation of the page. We've recreated our own Poland page, basically, which uses data and analytics that our teams have put together that pull data out of Bloomberg and FactSet and put them in a, it's sort of like a value line page, mm-hmm. but with the statistics that we want to see over time. And so our universe discussion is going basically through those companies one at a time. And saying, we don't cover this company. Let's look at the economics of the business based on what we have here on this page. Does anybody know this company or know the industry or know something like it? Should we bring this into coverage? And so that's also on Wednesday afternoons. And, probably once every few weeks, there's a new company added, at least to take a look at. A lot mm-hmm. of them don't make it past that initial research point. But, usually once in a while, someone will be like, you know what? We've seen this company a bunch of times. The economics look really nice. Don't know enough about it. Let's have somebody take a quick look at it.
I love that y'all have your own little, pull in one or two pagers with the metrics that mean most to mm-hmm. you, that matter most to you. So the analysts have freedom to look at any stock in the large cap universe across the world that meet your all five of your strict criteria. Mm-hmm. Are analysts ever assigned companies to research from the portfolio managers?
Yeah. I mean, that does happen from time to time. I would say less frequently than the analysts wanting to pick them up themselves.
Sure.
Oftentimes, the most common way is, either during the universe discussion or even outside the universe discussion, an analyst will say, hey, I think someone should take a look at this. I would like to do that. And our director of research, which is Brian Power, will decide, yeah, yes or no, or somebody else should look at it. But 90% of the time, if you bring it up, you'll get to look at it. There's no reason not to.
Right.
As long as you have the ability and the time to be able to do it, then sure, you can do it. We also don't hold super strict to the guardrails to start research. So if someone brings up a company that's not yet fully inside of our guardrails, but looks like it's getting closer, we'll look at it. We'll get ahead of some of those companies. We don't want to just be reactionary when all of a sudden the stars align, sure. Now we have to start our research. We do have an 11 person team, so we can go a little bit outside the guardrails just to get up to speed on companies. And then we're ready. Once they do come in the guardrails, we can then invest. We did that with Airbnb. Airbnb came public during COVID, really during 2020, late 2020, early 2021. And as a private company, it did not meet our guardrails. But we picked up coverage of it once they filed their registration statement, because we could tell right away that it would likely be well inside the guardrails very, very quickly. And so we had the research already started before it even came public. And we ended up purchasing the company not long after it came public. And so we have the ability to study companies even before they're in the guardrails.
You've mentioned on here that you listen to some of my shows and how some of my guests have talked about Value Line. I want to show you that I read all of your stuff. So I still remember your Airbnb blurb that you put in your quarterly letter, when I believe you said that you thought there was the potential over time for like 1,000 basis points of margin improvement.
And they've done a lot better than that.
That's exactly right.
In a very short period of time. Yeah.
It was incredible. It's incredible what they were able to achieve and scale.
I think I'm also learning that I'm quite conservative on margin improvement on network effect businesses. So I did the same thing when we bought MasterCard way back, you know, many, many, many years ago. MasterCard's margins at the time were roughly 20%. And I said, I think over time, their operating margins can get to at least 35%. And I mean,
which sounds like a lot, 15, yeah. You know, 15 percentage point improvement. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it sounded like a little bit of a prediction, right?
And right.
Now they're getting close to 60. So I tend to be a little, we all are, right? Pulling Capital's relatively conservative people, but you know, even when we make predictions, sometimes we can be wildly low, and I'd rather be wildly low and exceed those expectations. But sometimes it's kind of laughable, like in the case of MasterCard
with Airbnb. Back on it.
Yeah, with Airbnb, they, you know, we predicted about where they are now, a little bit lower than where they are now, but they're marching past it quite quickly, and they could get, I don't know if they will, because there's so many things they can invest in, but they could get up to MasterCard type margins if they let it.
Incredible, you know, with MasterCard and Visa, it's just that. You know, the incremental margins that a great wide moat business can own when they have a fixed cost business model and all of that infrastructure is built out, mm-hmm. or a lot of it is built out. And so every incremental dollar that flows across that infrastructure, you know, the margins on that are very, 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 very high. So
yeah, and the beauty, like, so Visa and MasterCard today, because their margins are already so high, means they don't have that same kind of flexibility. Like the incremental right. profitability is a less contributor to their earnings growth than obviously when they were, you know, teens margins, like, you know, every 100 basis points, you know, when you have a 16% margin, that's a lot better than every 1% on a 60, right? Yep. So right now we have that with Amazon, right? Amazon's margins, you know, bottomed at 1.9%. And our view is that they would get to likely the mid-teens over time. And they're already back to 8, you know, in less than a year. They went from 1.9 to 8.
Wow.
And so like incremental margins, when your margins are relatively lean like that, very lean, you know, that's massive cash flow growth, massive earnings growth. And those are kind of rare. You know, most of our companies have high margins already. And we're hopeful that they can just kind of keep, you know, expanding a little bit over time. But, you know, that's why we made such a large position in Amazon, was we saw the obviousness of this massive margin improvement that was coming. And it didn't take a lot of, you know, a lot of bold predictions on our part to make sure that was going to happen.
Yeah. So, you know, you've emphasized that y'all are bottoms up. You're looking for these best 150, 160, 170 companies in the world with, you know, long-term profitable growth ahead of them. But my question is, do you think about macro at all, and how much, or how does that flow into your process?
We used to always say that we never really cared about the macro, bottom up, blah blah blah, right?
But
the reality is, you never fully ignore the macro, because there are macro things that affect businesses that you better be aware of, right?
Sure.
And so some of those macro things are just the ebb and flow of the economy that we're a little bit less concerned with, because that's just the natural order of the economy, and our long-term holding periods and the advantage companies we have are going to be able to grow through that. But we do have to understand things like tariffs and trades, mm-hmm. and regulatory regimes, and massive impacts on currencies, you know, because our companies are mostly global businesses. They don't just operate in the US. So you do have to understand, you know, is there going to be any big currency risks in some of the geographies that they sell in? Are they naturally hedged against those currencies? We really have to understand things that can affect them that are exogenous to themselves. And so, you know, those are things that we do pay pretty close attention to. You know, we did see in 2022, that rapidly rising interest rates can have a very deleterious effect on the PE multiples of even the most advantaged companies in the world. And we underappreciated how big that could be. We knew there'd be multiple compression coming. We didn't expect it to be that big that fast. Mm-hmm. And our companies happened to hit a COVID grow over, which made the earnings growth quite low in that year too. So we kind of got stuck in a storm where if we maybe appreciated it a little bit, that duration impact, we could have protected the portfolio a little bit more by staying a little bit longer in some of the safety companies that we had sold before pivoting into some of the faster growth companies. I think we could have done a little bit better. on that. So we're still learning a little bit too, because we hadn't really seen a rapid rising rate environment in our 35 year history. And so it was, you know, now we know, but we do incorporate these things, but we don't become paralyzed by them either, right? If you're going to be able to own a great company that's going to compound for very long periods of time, and you know, you may have some headwinds, we're going to try to be a little bit tactical with how we add to it, maybe how much we own right away, but it's not going to stop us from owning great businesses that are going to be able to deliver, you know, exceptional earnings growth for decades.
Dan, you're one of the most humble people I know. And, you know, earlier in this discussion, you said that you haven't been, the team hasn't been exceptional at position sizing, meaning...
Meaning me, because I'm...
No. Meaning you haven't added a lot of alpha based on position sizing. The portfolio has done exceptional, but it's something that you are working on. And, you know, just now you said that you and your team underappreciated the multiple compression and how fast it happened once interest rates started rising very quickly. Mm-hmm. My question is, do you regret selling one or two of those safety stocks? And just for our listeners really quickly, Polin has historically invested across the growth spectrum, mm-hmm. meaning on one end, and I only know this because I've interviewed you so many times and spoken to you so many times, meaning on one end of the spectrum, you have some slower growers that are very safe and stable. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have some much faster growers that maybe have a wider range of outcomes.
That's right.
And you know, maybe O'Reilly was one of those in the past. Maybe Nestle or Unilever, I can't remember, was one of those in the past. Do you think you regret getting out of those safety growers, those safety stocks? And if so, do you look to add one or two of them in the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, first of all, on safeties, like you said it exactly right. Our safeties are a little bit slower growing, but they are very, very stable. And today you could think of companies like Abbott Labs in that. Accenture, Zoetis. Like these are companies that are very, very stable. They're not slow growing. They're just slower than our portfolio average. So they still are double-digit earnings growers, which is a lot faster than, say, the S&P 500 earnings growth. But they're on the low end of our portfolio, right?
Right.
And there is always a place for those companies. You know, we love to have them. You know, we don't have like a targeted percentage of safeties. It's basically what the market will give us. If safeties are available at good prices, we're happy to own them. If they're not, you know, that's fine. We'll find other places to go. In the time period that we're talking about, which is, you know, late 2021, let me give you my thought process on why we sold some of those. And yes, I do regret the timing of some of those sales, but the logic, I think, made sense. But if I'd known then what I know now, we would have waited a little bit longer. And in late 2021, you know, everything felt a little expensive, kind of like it does now, actually. And everything felt a little expensive. And we looked at our portfolio company by company. And the way we think about valuation is, you know, what is the return, the expected return on this company over the next 5 years, given a combination of earnings growth we expect and likely multiple compression, right? Most of our companies over time, the multiples will compress a little bit over time. And what we want from each one of our companies is at least a double digit annualized return to continue to own it. If it starts to fall into the single digit, you know, total return category, we're really less interested. We're going to find something else. Now, in late 2021, I wrote a commentary where I said our portfolio was trading on the high side of normal. That's the terminology I used. Mm-hmm. And I used it very specifically because I didn't feel that the companies in the portfolio were overvalued. It was just that path to a double-digit return was getting narrow. It was getting hard for them to get much higher than that. There were two companies in particular where we were saying it's likely to be down into the single digits. It's not going to be a double-digit annualized return. And we sold those two companies. It was Dollar General and Starbucks.
Right.
And the interesting thing about that is I'm telling everybody that valuations are high and what I'm selling are safeties, not the faster growing companies, because we felt the valuations and safeties were actually worse than in the growth companies. And so we sold those two companies. And my logic at the time, and I talked about it with our team, is look, we know that PE multiples are going to contract as interest rates start to rise, right? Remember, this is at the time where the 10-year is like 1%. Right. We know interest rates are going to start to rise. PE multiples are going to contract. Safeties are expensive. We're having to sell them. So the way we can fight this multiple compression is by leaning into growth, leaning into faster growing companies, because the valuations are better there anyway. We can go in that direction. And so we started to add Amazon, and we used the proceeds of Dollar General to buy Amazon. We leaned in on Netflix. We leaned in on a few of these faster growing companies. The only problem with that decision was those same companies were about to hit on tough comparisons from the COVID period when they saw accelerating. So we leaned in on faster growing companies right as they kind of hit stall speed a little bit, right? So our normal earnings growth is 15, 16%. Even in a recession, we can typically get 10% earnings growth, which is pretty awesome in a recession. In 2022, we only ended up with 5% earnings growth because of the stall out on some of the digital and healthcare businesses on tough COVID growovers.
Yeah.
So we're eating multiple compression, right, on higher PE multiple companies because these faster growers had higher PE multiples and their earnings stalled out at the same time. And so, you know, I didn't anticipate the growover being that difficult. I didn't anticipate the PE multiple compression from duration and interest rates to be that big. So it ended up being a much larger double headwind than I thought. So had I really appreciated those two things, we would have hung around the Starbucks and Dollar Generals a little bit longer, even though the valuations were not that great, and maybe waited a little bit longer to lean in on Amazon and Netflix and similar businesses. You know, once those growers were fully appreciated, you know, I think we could have been tactically a lot better at it. Now, our portfolio still would have been down a fair amount in 2022, just because, you know, the businesses that we own, as we've kind of talked about, are, you know, financially superior, highly competitively advantaged. They don't trade at discounts to the market. They trade at premiums to the market typically. So the duration impact was going to hit us kind of hard no matter what. Even if we had, you know, done a little bit better with our tactical positioning, we still would have been down a lot. But we could have done better for sure. We could have protected some of the returns that year, I'm sure.
And I mean, I think, I don't know how you think about it, but I think you've got some great safeties in there. Like you mentioned Accenture and Abbott Labs, but even, you know, a Visa or a MasterCard, a Microsoft. I don't know. I'm just thinking off the top of my head.
We've made an argument, and we actually wrote a white paper on this, that SaaS software businesses are safety-like.
Right, yeah.
And what we meant by that, we were trying to be a little provocative, but what we meant by that was the 100% recurring nature of essential software makes it as durable as like a Nestle or a Coca-Cola, arguably better even than those businesses. Of course, the first time we got tested on that was a duration like PE multiple compression. So the businesses themselves were extraordinarily durable. Those companies continued to grow with almost no slowdown through the last 5 years. But the stock prices ended up being more volatile because the PE multiples were higher. And so they ate the duration impact a little bit, much more than we would have expected. In a more normal, say like a recession-driven drawdown or a valuation-driven drawdown, I think a lot of our businesses, even our faster growing ones, have very safety-like qualities to the businesses. Yeah.
So, you know, you talked a lot about in the last 10 minutes or so, multiple compression, and you mentioned that you even assume some multiple compression in your valuations in a lot of cases, because these companies are faster growing, extremely high quality, and they trade at premiums to the market. So, just how does your team think about valuation, and what valuation methods are you typically using?
So again, there's a lot of autonomy here. You know, I know a lot of people try to do discounted cash flow models, and I built those in the past too. I don't like the false precision of a DCF model, because you naturally like put numbers into the spreadsheet and it elegantly spits out a number, and then you're incredibly anchored to that number. What I do like about those models is seeing how the cash flows change based on your assumption changes for revenue growth and margins and capital intensity. It's good to see what the biggest levers are in value creation for companies, right? So obviously on a company like Amazon with extremely low margins, it's highly sensitive to the margins that you predict you know, where a company with already high profit margins, that they have a lot of flexibility in managing the expenses of the business, it's much more going to be the revenue growth that drives it. So it's cool to see how that all plays out. But you know, for us, like I said, we tend to look at this in an expected return construct, and we have an idea of, you know, the earnings growth. Obviously, we know what the earnings growth is today, or the earnings power is today. We have a prediction on what it's going to look like 5 years from now. Now, on the average company, that would be ludicrous to like try to predict 5 years from now what the earnings power is going to be. But remember, the types of businesses that we're investing in tend to be on fairly consistent and linear growth paths, often in industries that they dominate and often industries that they themselves created. And so it's relatively, we walked through the growth algorithm on Visa and MasterCard before. It's a pretty predictable number. Now, we're not going to get it, you know, spot on bullseye accurate, but we're not going to be wildly off either. So the biggest variable then is the multiple 5 years from now. Like, what's going to be the multiple? That's harder to predict, right? So what we do is we just kind of stress test it. You know, what kind of multiple would have to sustain 5 years from now for us to achieve that double digit return? And is that reasonable? And we do it based on a normalized interest rate environment. We never give credit in the out years to, you know, a lower than normal interest rate environment that would allow for higher than average PE multiples. We want to assume kind of a normal interest rate environment. And so from here to there, what does that look like? Now, the analysts themselves, myself included, we can use any valuation technique you want. You know, you can build yourself a super complicated model if you want, but that's not going to be part of the decision making on putting a company into the portfolio. Again, crayon simple. You know, what's it going to look like 5 years from now? If it's hard to predict, it's probably not for us. It's probably not something we should have in our portfolio. If it's something where the outcomes are just wild, you know, it could be, you know, five times the current size or half the current size, but, you know, not interested in those, right, in those businesses. We want companies that have pretty predictable growth and, you know, a reasonableness to their valuation that we can predict. You know, we don't ever really predict multiple expansion for our companies. We assume that it'll be the same or lower. You know, on the faster growing companies, we build in more multiple compression because they're going to be slower growing at the end of that 5 year window. So not only do we have to have an expectation of what the 5 year growth is going to be, you also have to have an expectation of what it's going to look like in 5 years from there, because that's going to be an impact on how big the multiple is 5 years. If we have a 20% grower, you know, for the next 5 years, but by year five, it's going to be like a 3% grower, well, then the multiple is going to be quite low, right? You know, that 5 year number. So you have to have kind of an idea of how growth is going to continue beyond the 5 year window.
That was great. So I'm going to pull on this string just a bit. So let's assume you find what you believe to be a super high quality, wide moat, you know, multiple overlapping moats, long duration, profitable growth company that meets all 5 year guardrails. And it's currently trading at a next 12 month PE of 30.
Yeah.
Roughly speaking, how fast would your expectations for EPS growth have to be? And how much would the PE have to drop on 5 year out numbers for the valuation to sort of be attractive to you?
Yeah, so I can't do that math in my head right now. Okay. But luckily we have a tool for this that I think you've seen before. We have a heat map that essentially does exactly the calculation that you're laying out there. We have two axes that we look at. On one axis is the expected earnings per share growth rate, and on the other axis is the PE multiple contraction, you know, that we would expect. And so you say, like, for you know, XYZ company, if it's going to be a 30% or a 20% earnings grower, we'll go down to that 20% earnings growth. And obviously, if the multiple doesn't change, we would expect a 20% return,
right?
But then we say, all right, well, let's build in, you know, what kind of multiple contraction do we have to build in to still maintain that double digit number, right? And so then we'll say, well, does that sound reasonable? And you know, if a company's growing fast enough, you can withstand a ton of multiple compression and still get a double digit annualized return.
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes on the companies that we're buying that are some of our fastest growers, you can withstand, you know, a 30, 40, 50% reduction in the PE multiple and still get a double digit or better annualized return. So, you know, that's kind of the way we think about it, is let's go to that heat map. You know, what's our best expectation of earnings? What kind of multiple contraction, you know, can we withstand and still get a double digit return? Does that look good to us? And then, of course, you don't want to just say, well, that's what it is. what if our expectation is off a little bit on the earnings growth? And if we are off on the earnings growth, the multiple is likely to come down even more. So let's, you know, what's the worst case kind of scenario? You know, if we expect a company to be a 15% grower over the next 5 years, a big error for us would be like it's 10, right? That's a big error for us. You know, we're really pretty close on these things over time. It's not going to be a minus 10, right? So if we say, all right, and we own Fastenal for a period of time, by the way, speaking of cyclical businesses, we own Fastenal and we had an expectation of Fastenal being a 15% grower. It turned out to be a 10 and the multiple contracted over that period of time by about a third over that period of time. And it gave us a basically zero return over a 4 year holding period. And so again, it was an opportunity cost. It was pretty big.
But not a blow up.
Right. So that's the beauty of dealing with companies that have some consistency to them is you're never going to be that far off on the earnings growth. So you just have to be, you know, conservative on the multiple, right? You just can't be too far out over your skis on the multiple. And we've historically been pretty good at that.
That was awesome. Lovely. Thank you. Under what circumstances do you trim and under what circumstances do you sell out completely?
Yeah, trimming usually ends up being something like a valuation, you know, call, you know, where the valuation is just a little bit high. It shouldn't be one of our larger positions. If the valuation is not giving us a great look at a return, maybe something else is giving us a better potential future return. Sometimes we just have some concerns about either the business itself or maybe a management decision, or maybe there's just a timeliness factor to it. You know, we own companies for such long periods of time, they all go through bumps along the way. And some of those bumps take a little bit of time to work out. And so if you're going through a period where you think there may be a year of, you know, not as exciting growth, maybe the growth is going to hit a pause for a little bit before reaccelerating, you might want to have a little bit lower position for a while others in the portfolio are compounding a bit faster. So it's usually, you know, when there's either a shorter term valuation issue or a shorter term, you know, business issue that will likely work itself out over time, we may trim. The sellouts could be for a number of reasons, but the most common reason is because we find something better, right? So the typical reason for an exit is that we found another idea that's, you know, not our 23rd best idea, right? And so that's the most common reason. But if we think that there's a potential risk to the competitive advantage or a real risk to the long-term growth profile, yeah, we'll exit those businesses if we think the thesis is just not going to be good going forward or different. We've had times where we thought management was very poorly allocating capital, where we'll exit the position entirely. If the company does something that pushes outside of our guardrails, we will have a serious discussion about, you know, how long is it going to be outside the guardrails? If it's going to be a relatively short period of time, we can be patient. Oftentimes acquisitions may push the debt levels a little bit too high. As long as there's a plan to get that back under control quickly, we can stay. But if it's something that changes the financial characteristics of the business, so it's unlikely to meet our hurdles, we'll probably exit that business too.
Dan, I started this show by highlighting the Poland Focus Growth Strategy's consistent outperformance over time with 5, 10, and 35-year annualized returns net of all fees of around 14%. And Dan, I've known you for a while. As I said, I first interviewed you and your partner Damon Ficklin in 2016, and then I interviewed you both again in 2018, and we've collaborated in other ways over the years as well. For example, I brought you and Damon and Raina Lesser-Hanaway, another of your colleagues, to speak to the investing team on different occasions when I was at the Motley Fool. And back in 2018, when I asked you and Damon about what was the primary driver of your consistent returns of 14%, y'all provided me one of my favorite investing quotes of all time. I don't even know if there's a question here, Dan, but I just want to read this quote to kind of close out our show. And so you and Damon told me, quote, "The primary driver of our returns has been earnings per share growth. Yeah. But of course, strong revenue growth is the primary way that has occurred for our companies.
Yeah.
It is important that each company have a big competitive advantage in a large growth market. That allows the revenue to grow without competition and for margins to expand, leading to strong earnings growth." End quote.
Yeah.
So I just love that quote. Is that your secret sauce, really finding these companies that you believe are early in their profit cycle?
They're not always early in their profit cycle. Just to be clear, they're not. Oftentimes we're kind of late to the party on some of these. Uh-huh. They have to be really proven. It's the discipline though of sticking with those.
Yes.
Right? It's the discipline of not chasing butterflies. It's the discipline of, even when you're underperforming, but you're still delivering the earnings growth, to not change what you do. And you know, we're a little bit lucky, Damon and I, especially the longest tenured members of the team, because we got to work with David Poland for a long time, and see and study not just him and how he worked, but his whole track record and understanding, you know, 20 years worth of work before we even got here, 15 to 20 years before we even got here, so that we knew it already worked, and we mm-hmm. knew that it required discipline and you had to kind of stick to it. And so that I think is exactly it. It's looking for those highly competitively advantaged companies that can deliver revenue and earnings growth in a very differentiated way, you know, for long periods of time, and just sticking with that. You know, there's a lot in our industry that is either fad or fashion oriented, or just people really want to look smart, you know, mm-hmm. and want to discover things that other people don't. There's almost the need to be more, you know, either a detective or a scientist or whatever, you know, something that makes you look really, really smart. I think what Poland Capital has done really well, and it came from our founder, is not trying to look smart. It's trying to do it, like we've said a couple times now, the easiest possible way with discipline. You know, and if we can do that and consistently do that, you're just allowing that compounding engine to keep on going, right? I think that's the most important thing. It's staying in the game, not making big mistakes, compounding over long periods of time. It doesn't have to be very fast, right? Compounding at 15% may not sound, I mean, you have an appreciation for this, John. You know that that's very fast. Mm-hmm. When you think about 15% per annum, like most people who don't understand the power of compounding may say, well, all right, 15%, you know, I can get 40%, you know, or whatever. Doing 15 over decades is really hard, really but hard. It's doable if you have a good process and philosophy underneath it. And we're just sticking to that. That's what we're doing.
And such a great lesson in there. You said you don't necessarily have to be early. Mm-hmm. If the company is as great as your research would believe it to be, if it ends up being as great, and you can buy equity in that company at a fair price, then you know, the Poland way would just be to do so and hold it,
yeah,
and be disciplined about holding it as long as it remains great, correct?
Yeah, and the idea too is, you know, you've heard me say it a few times, I'm not talking about individual company growth, we're talking about portfolio level growth, right? Yep. So, you know, each company contributes to that, of course, but not all of them are fast growers. Some of them are slower, but they all have to contribute. And then it's up to us to say, well, if this company cannot carry its load, just pull it out, move it aside. Mm-hmm. We'll find mm-hmm. another one. We talked about years ago, we had owned American Express for 14 years, you know, in the 1990s and into the 2000s. And we thought they were lending very aggressively in an undisciplined way before the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. And they had one kind of poor quarter, you know, where they had to increase their delinquencies increased, and it looked, you know, not Amex-like. And after a 14-year holding period, we sold that company in one day. You know, we just said they are risking the franchise, they're risking the brand, they're risking what makes them unique and special, and we're out. You know, so we tend to be very long term, but we're also pretty ruthless if we think that the compounding engine is at risk. You know, we can always find another one to keep the portfolio compounding earnings and that mid-teens rate. So we're not married to any of them. We love, you know, owning companies like Accenture for 17 years. But if we thought something, you know, popped up that made Accenture not what we would like it to be, it's out. We'll find another one. You know, we need to be able to change our mind, to move forward, keep the compounding going.
Yeah, Dan, y'all really do think about it at the portfolio level, compounding earnings at a mid-teens rate at the portfolio level for as long as you can. And you also think a lot about doing whatever it takes to prevent interrupting that compounding.
Exactly.
And if a company really surprises you out of nowhere with something, you know, whether it's, you know, bad lending standards that don't meet their historical criteria, whether it's a bad acquisition, you know, a string of bad capital allocation decisions you don't agree with, you'll get out and rethink it.
Yeah. And that's okay. And we can come back, right? Sometimes
exactly.
We say, okay, well, we were worried. It really never really happened. No problem. We can come back again. That's okay. You know, that the idea is don't lose money, right? Do everything you can to make sure that the worst case scenario is an opportunity cost.
Yes.
Put yourself in the way of great businesses and let them do the hard work for you, right? We don't need to. But before I came to Poland Capital, I was a deep value analyst. And I just found that really, really hard, right? You're basically trying to just capture value the way they did it. You're trying to capture valuation anomalies, right? On relatively poor companies, right? You just thought they were overbeaten down and then they would eventually get valued higher. You have to do a lot of hard work as the investor then, you know, to generate the return by constantly identifying undervalued companies. In the types of businesses that we invest, the companies are compounding all the time. They're doing the hard work for us, right? Yes. If their earnings compound and we're pretty disciplined on the price that we pay, the company's doing all that hard work. That's why we've only had to own 132 of them, you know, in 35 years, because they're doing all the hard work. We're just allowing them to do it. And if it looks like something's wrong, we just push one aside and bring a new one in.
Dan, this was incredible. We dove very deep into the Poland investing process. Is there anything we missed or anything else I should have asked you about Poland, its process, or how the team is structured?
John, I think you know us as well as anyone who works inside of Poland Capital.
Thank you.
Knows us. So no, I think we really covered a lot. I just want to tell you, I appreciate the way you get to know investment managers and their philosophy and process and articulate it so smoothly. I think you can tell the Poland story as well as anybody can. And I've heard you do it with other investment managers as well. And so I just appreciate a great thoughtful discussion as usual.
Dan, I really, really appreciate you saying that. Thank you so much for coming on to the JRO show. And before we sign off, I'd like to provide a quick reminder. Anything discussed on the JRO show by myself or my guest is solely our own opinions and does not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. The JRO show is for entertainment purposes only, so please do your own research on any securities discussed in this podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.